Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Mark Colvin. Among our stories tonight, a setback for the federal government's healthcare overhaul as Victoria's Premier John Brumby releases his own plan. The Prime Minister is not happy. And one of China's most prominent dissidents who disappeared more than a year ago has now emerged a different man. Gao Zhisheng is thinner and subdued and says that he's giving up activism.
I might disappoint everyone because I do not want to talk about what happened in the past. I want to have a future over which I have some relative control. I do not want to talk about what happened in the past anymore.
Those stories coming up. But first, compared to some of its neighbours in Central Asia, Kyrgyzstan is small and landlocked, but it's strategically placed so the international community is watching anxiously to see what happens next in the apparent overthrow of the president. Protesters are back on the streets of the Kyrgyz capital, Bishkek, this evening, but the security forces so far are nowhere to be seen. Yesterday, at least 65, maybe more than 100 people were killed as security forces lashed out at anti-government protests in the centre of the capital. The president has been forced to flee to his home region. The new government says it wants to negotiate to get him to relinquish power. The self-proclaimed new administration is promising to hold fresh elections within 6 months and to clean up corruption. And it says there'll be no change to the status of Russian and US military bases in the country. Shane McLeod reports.
Bishkek is a city seemingly returning to normal today, but there's plenty of evidence of the violence and disarray that look to have resulted in the arrival of a new government and constitution. Burnt-out cars and armoured trucks with deflated tyres are outside government buildings, and while small groups of protesters are gathering, what's not there confronting them today are the security forces. Clashes yesterday resulted in the deaths of at least 65 people and maybe many more. The protests were sparked by a government decision to double the price of electricity, but there was already simmering anger about corruption and nepotism, especially in President Kurmanbek Bakiyev's placing of his unpopular son at the centre of economic and political power. In the past few hours, the woman who's assumed the role as head of the new self-declared government, Rosa Otunbayeva, has been outlining the future for the country in her first media conference as leader. Earlier, she told the BBC it was time for a just and fair government.
For our task is to fix the situation, to set up the rule of new life, first of all, to adopt the new constitution and the new bodies. This will be a new, honest and just government.
Rosa Otunbayeva says despite efforts by her group to encourage the president to resign, he has instead fled to the south of the country and his home region of Jalalabad. That's one area she says her administration hasn't been able to assert control over. But she says the new government has taken over key ministries and hopes to negotiate with the president to have him relinquish power peacefully. It's only 5 years ago that President Bakiyev was coasting to power on the wave of another display of people power. It was the so-called Tulip Revolution. Today, the Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin was giving his thoughts on why the president's term appears to have failed.
It has taken me personally completely by surprise. At the same time, I recall when President Bakiyev came to power, he criticised the previous president for nepotism in Kyrgyzstan. I have the impression now that Mr. Bakiyev is making the same mistakes.
Rosa Otunbayeva was an influential figure in the Tulip Revolution. What many analysts are looking for now are signs of whether she and her new government can consolidate power and avoid further violence with the outgoing president and his supporters. There's also the question of how it will interact with key powers, Russia and the United States. The US is keen to ensure continued operation of its military base that's a key staging point for its operations in Afghanistan. It had to renegotiate the terms of that lease last year after Parliament voted to end it. From the Australian National University in Canberra, Dr. Kirill Nozhanov believes Rosa Otunbayeva may have difficulty asserting control.
Politics in Kyrgyzstan is an extremely mosaic-like fractured affair, and whether Otunbayeva can compel all the rival clans and groups to sit down and indeed form a working government remains very much a big question.
Chris Weifer is chief strategist with Russian investment company Uralsib Capital. He says the signs are that Kyrgyzstan's politics won't settle down anytime soon.
There's not going to be any sort of magic wand or any magic formulas to change the situation. Kyrgyzstan is one of the poorest countries in the world. People are extremely frustrated, and they've now shown twice in 5 years that they're very able and very willing to express that frustration on the streets. So the next government coming in will be looking over its shoulder all the time and will be under a great deal of pressure to deliver from day one.
There are a number of Australian companies with ties to Kyrgyzstan, many of them involved in mining and energy. One of them is the listed Brisbane-based company Kentor Gold. Managing Director Simon Milroy says if the new government achieves control, he doesn't think there'll be much impact on companies like his.
I think there is certainly a short-term effect from it. It certainly reflects badly on the sort of political risk situation. Given the past revolution in 2005, the country got over it very quickly. Within about a month, the new government was installed and functioning and operating very efficiently. So we believe it's a fairly short-term effect, and hopefully within 4 to 6 weeks it'll be business as usual in the country.
Kyrgyzstan's new government says it plans to draft a new constitution with a view to holding fresh elections in 6 months' time.
Shane McLeod. After weeks of to-ing and fro-ing over Kevin Rudd's health overhaul plan, the Victorian Premier has thrown a spanner in the works. John Brumby has released his own proposal. The Prime Minister wants to assume 60% control of public hospital funding, using one-third of the state's GST money. Today, Mr. Brumby's proposed instead a 50-50 funding partnership. Kevin Rudd's brief response is that he has a mandate for his plan. From Canberra, Alexandra Kirk reports.
Kevin Rudd's health and hospitals plan takes a leaf out of Victoria's book, with local health networks and activity-based funding paying a yet-to-be-determined efficient price for every public hospital treatment of a public patient. But from day one, Premier John Brumby hasn't bought it, nor have his New South Wales and West Australian counterparts. The Victorian Premier's taken the pulse of his constituents and come up with his own reform blueprint.
Putting patients first sets up a workable and coherent set of reforms which we believe, will transform Australia's health system for the better.
Premier Brumby's led the charge against the Prime Minister's bid to assume majority control of all public hospital services. His main gripe is there's no extra federal money for years.
Unless we can get more money, more resources, more support for patients now, there is nothing in this plan for Victoria.
John Brumby's keen to strike a deal at the heads of government meeting in 11 days' time, but is adamant it has to be the right plan, proposing a simplified funding model.
Firstly, it proposes straightforward financing. That includes seeing the Commonwealth lift its effort to match that of our state and that of the states generally, returning to the old partnership, the successful partnership of 50-50 funding. In Victoria's case, that would mean the Commonwealth lifting their contribution, an injection of funding of $1.2 billion per annum into our state. And under our proposals, the state and the state alone will be accountable to the public and to patients for patient care. Our plan also includes new national standards through what will be an Australian Health Pact. Every man, woman and child would know exactly what standards are expected in our health system.
His position of strength is that Victoria is widely regarded as having the nation's best performing healthcare system and as such forms the bedrock of the Rudd plan.
And the bottom line is that in Victoria, our health system is now treating something like 700,000 more patients than it did a decade ago.
John Brumby doesn't think much of Mr Rudd wanting to hive off one-third of state and territory GST revenue. His plan wouldn't yield any funds to the Commonwealth.
Not just a recycling of GST payments, but an increase in Commonwealth funding to lift Commonwealth expenditure to a genuine 50-50 partnership.
The Brumby counter-offensive struck a chord with the Federal Opposition's health spokesman, Peter Dutton.
We want better patient outcomes, so I think Kevin Rudd is after a better political outcome, and I think John Brumby is highlighting that at the moment. So the Prime Minister needs to explain whether or not this is just a pea and thimble trick with his so-called dominant funder, whether or not it's going to involve extra bureaucrats, which I think John Brumby is worried about, and why under the Prime Minister's plan is he proposing to pull the Victorian system back to level pegging with the New South Wales and Queensland system. Clearly those two systems are on their knees, and why would we bring the rest of the states down to a lowest common denominator?
The Health Minister, Nicola Roxon, isn't commenting. She met her New South Wales counterpart, Carmel Tebbutt, again today in a bid to convince the biggest state to sign up.
So when did you first feel the symptoms?
Well, I've been in here for a month now.
Wow.
Yeah, a week before that.
What's the name of this disease?
Myelodosis.
Okay.
Kevin Rudd's continuing his hospital visits, distributing millions for cancer services and spruiking his plan. Behind the scenes, the federal government talks as if it has health reform in the bag. Publicly, the Prime Minister's keeping up the tough talk.
As Prime Minister, I was elected with a mandate to deliver better health and hospital services for all Australians. Therefore, I would just urge John to work with the Australian government, because state governments cannot afford to fund this system for the future. The Australian government must be the dominant funder for the future.
In John Brumby, he may have met his match.
All of the modelling that we've done shows that there is just nothing in this for Victorian patients. There's no extra money. All that's happening is a recycling of the GST. And the additional effort, again, going forward is all state effort, not Commonwealth effort. So I think you're going to find a number of states have great difficulty in agreeing to hand over one of their taxes to the Commonwealth, who just recycles it back with their label on it. But it doesn't change health care.
And Victorian Health Minister Daniel Andrews is just as determined.
At the end of the day, health is complex enough without putting in place convoluted, incoherent, and quite frankly, impractical policies that are not funded and that will not treat additional patients and will not treat them faster.
Victorian Health Minister Daniel Andrews, ending that report from Alexandra Kirk. The Chinese coal carrier Shennung 1 remains stuck on the Great Barrier Reef east of Rockhampton tonight. The Queensland government says workers are completing preparations to transfer oil from the vessel. ABC reporter Donna Field is just back from a helicopter flight over the stranded ship. First of all, just what could you see?
Well, Mark, there's a lot of activity out there. There are a lot of boats, a couple of tugs holding the Shennung in place. Then there are another couple of boats which have these booms on board that will contain any oil if it's spilt when it's pumped off the Chinese carrier to a barge. That barge is also there. So certainly in that area there are a lot of boats. We saw some turtles and a shark just near the bulk carrier, which is quite amazing. They were right on the side of it. So while the coral underneath it has been crushed, and you can see that from the air, there is marine life around there.
What was that long, white, sort of whitish, creamy sort of stain that we could see on the aerial footage in the first couple of days?
That's the crushed coral. So basically when the vessel hit the shoal, it moved about 20 or 30 metres after that before it was secured with these tugs. So in the process, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority says it's created a bit of an excavation of that area, crushing that coral. And by all accounts, if the water quality is good, it can regenerate. But different scientists I've spoken to say, well, basically that coral's a goner.
But this barge that's there to take the oil off, is that manoeuvring alongside, or will they have pipes going from the Shennung to the barge?
It's going to pull up alongside, and then they'll have pipes that will go into it. And all 950 tonnes of oil on board the Chinese carrier will go into that bunker. There won't be return trips to Gladstone to unload back and forwards. It will all be able to be accommodated in that, it's called a barge bunker. And so we should see that starting to happen by tomorrow. We expected it to happen today, but the authorities who are managing this salvage say that it's not a race. They're not going to rush it because they just don't want to see any further oil spilt in the area or any mistakes, basically. So
they don't expect any big tropical storms or anything?
No, look, the weather, it's amazing. In this region, a couple of weeks ago, we had Cyclone Alui, and you know, it would have been such a different outcome if that was now. And everyone's just saying, you know, it's the weather's been on their side. Basically, it's calm waters out there. There were no whitecaps as we were, you know, looking down today. It, you know, there's waves, but they're not very big. And certainly when you look at the ship, it doesn't look like it's grounded as such. It's got, you know, water around it, but it's on a slight angle, so therefore you can kind of tell that it is wedged into that shoal.
If they do get the oil out, what then? Because you've still got a tanker full of coal. Is there any way of floating the ship a little bit to actually float it off the reef?
The authorities say what they're going to do is get the oil off and then look at whether they'll keep the coal on board and refloat or take the coal off. Apparently getting coal off is a whole other matter. It's very, very difficult logistically. So they're going to get the oil off and then make that decision. Their plan is, with refloating, that they will wait for a tide, and that may be a week away, a higher tide, and then try to refloat. While all this kind of organisations going on in terms of the oil, there's also a lot of work going on board in terms of putting concrete into the hole in that fuel tank that was breached when the tanker crashed. So there's, you know, engineers, architects on board, marine architects who are all working to make sure that the ship can be refloated at some stage.
Donna Field, thank you very much. A Chinese human rights lawyer who disappeared more than a year ago has resurfaced as a changed man. Before he disappeared, Gao Zhisheng was a dissident known for taking on tough civil liberties cases. Rumours said that he'd been tortured by state security agents and was even feared dead. Mr. Gao has now emerged, appearing thinner and subdued, and declared that he's giving up activism. He said he didn't want to discuss who took him or what they did to him, just that his priority now was to be reunited with his family members who fled to the United States at the beginning of last year. China correspondent Stephen McDonnell reports.
Gao Zhisheng came to prominence by representing the likes of underground Christian groups and members of the banned Falun Gong sect in court. But in China, some human rights lawyers become activists themselves. Mr. Gao was one such lawyer. In 2007, he was picked up by security agents and reportedly given electric shocks to his genitals and tortured with cigarettes. A year ago, he disappeared again. His supporters feared the worst. Foreign reporters regularly asked Chinese government officials where he'd been taken. The answers they gave were evasive and added to the speculation that maybe he was dead. But last week, as journalists waited in Shanghai for the verdict in the Rio Tinto case, out of the blue, Gao Zhisheng called Reuters in Beijing. If it was really him speaking, then he was alive. He said he'd arrived at a Buddhist retreat on Mount Wutai in Shanxi province. This seemed so out of character that many questioned if it could be true. Now he's returned to Beijing and on arrival announced that his days of activism are over.
I might disappoint everyone because I do not want to talk about what happened in the past. If my aim is to bid farewell to the past and leave it behind completely, what happened is not important anymore. I want to have a future over which I have some relative control. I do not want to talk about what happened in the past anymore.
According to the Associated Press reporter who saw him, he appeared thin and subdued. Gao Zhisheng would not talk about who picked him up over a year ago and what they did to him. This has led to speculation that he's still under police surveillance. He did talk about how in the past he's been able to survive being tortured.
I have a special characteristic, and that's no matter the circumstances, I can control my feelings or my emotions. It's like a mechanical function, and I don't allow my emotions to move and turn.
Gao Zhisheng's wife and children fled to the United States at the beginning of last year. He says his only priority now is to reunite with them.
Yesterday night, when I returned home, I saw my wife and children's shoes lying on the ground, right in the same place as they used to be. I completely lost control of my emotions, because to me, these are the three dearest people in the world, and now we're like a kite with a broken string.
And in terms of his decision to abandon his work as a lawyer and activist,
You know, the main basis for choosing to give up is for the sake of family feelings. So to get together with my family in the future is undoubtedly instinctive, an instinctive goal. I hope I can reunite with them. My children need me by their side growing up.
The experiences of Gao Zhisheng are far from the norm in China. Most Chinese people wouldn't even know who he is. And it's true that dissidents like him are running into serious trouble after challenging the Chinese state's right to behave the way it does. But this human rights lawyer is also a reminder that this country is still a place of great danger for those who fall foul of the authorities in certain ways, and that the legal system here, as Gao Zhisheng knows too well, will not offer them any refuge from the excesses of abusive power. This is Stephen McDonald in Beijing for PM.
Around Australia on ABC Radio, internationally on Radio Australia and streaming live online from the PM website, this is PM. Still to come, first home buyers forced to come up with bigger deposits as banks change their lending criteria. Voters in Sri Lanka are going to the polls today in the country's first parliamentary elections since the army eliminated all military opposition and overran the last Tamil Tiger bases less than a year ago. The Sri Lankan president, Mahinda Rajapaksa, cast his ballot in his home district in the south of the country. He's confident of winning, but after years of civil war, how free and fair have these elections been? I'm joined on the line by our South Asia correspondent, Sally Sara. First of all, just describe the scene and the turnout, Sally.
Well, the turnout so far, it's been relatively quiet here in Colombo. People have, a lot of women particularly, vote early in the capital. We were at a polling station this morning watching voters go through. There are a large number, about 80,000 security forces have been deployed across the country. So far it's been relatively orderly. There have been some reports of possible shooting incident at some vehicles at Gaul overnight, but things seem to be unfolding smoothly at this stage.
Are all the candidates who might be campaigning, have they all been able to campaign?
Some of the opposition candidates are saying that the main complaint that they have is that the government has used the state media in its favour, not only to put forward its own message, but that the state media has given very limited coverage to the opposition candidates. There have also been some incidents of violence in the lead-up to the campaign, and obviously in the past week the other issue that's grabbed a lot of headlines has been monks who've been protesting here in the capital, Colombo. They've been demanding the release of opposition candidate General South Fonseca, who's in detention. Several of those monks were arrested earlier in the week, and that has hit a very sensitive nerve for many people in Sri Lanka who believe that the monks should be handled with great care. People are unhappy about the police response to that.
Why is General South Fonseca behind bars?
Well, General Sarath Fonseca, of course, was a former military commander here in Sri Lanka. At the end of last year, he finished his military career and announced that he'd be standing in the presidential election. He lost that election to the President Mahinda Rajapaksa. He's now in detention facing court-martial for allegedly politicking while he was still in uniform before he retired. So, ironically, he's actually still a candidate in this poll, but he'll be spending election day still remaining in detention.
How does the international community take that in terms of checking that this is a free and fair election?
There are some international monitors. This hasn't been as high profile as the presidential election with all the tension that was there. Really, here in Sri Lanka, it's expected that the ruling party will have quite a comfortable victory. And the question now really is whether they can reach the mark of getting a two-thirds majority, which would then enable them to carry out constitutional changes without having to rely on opposition support.
And how free and fair do you think the elections have been in the areas that used to be controlled by the LTTE, the Tamil Tigers?
There have been some reports this morning of some buses going to get some of the displaced people being blocked up in those areas. I guess it's almost as if there are two Sri Lankas in some ways. In the south, people are voting on two issues, and they are peace and prosperity. Many people loyal to the government say, look, this is the regime that ended the civil war and it's now delivering a great economic improvement to the people of Sri Lanka. But in the north, many of the members of the Tamil and Muslim minorities feel that they haven't been included, and they, as they voted against the President Rajapaksa in the presidential election, they're expected to vote against the government this time as well.
And from a purely Australian point of view, is there anything about the likely result of this election that could affect the flow of refugees out of Sri Lanka and towards us?
Well, we spoke yesterday with the foreign minister here in Sri Lanka. The government is continuing its line, which it's had for many months, and that is it believes that there's no reason for Tamils to flee Sri Lanka, that it's they have democracy and freedom of choice here, and that the government of Sri Lanka is also urging the federal government in Australia not to let those asylum seekers through, not to recognise them in any circumstances. So that line, there doesn't appear to be any sign that that will change, and that's the way that the Sri Lankan government is viewing the asylum seeker issue.
Sally Sarah, thank you very much. Sally Sarah in Colombo, Sri Lanka there. The federal government's accused the opposition of flip-flopping on population after the coalition's immigration spokesman revealed that his comments on the issue should not be considered as policy. 2 days ago, Scott Morrison signalled that a coalition government would slash overseas migration if it were brought into power. Now, after condemnation by some members of his own team and business groups, he says too much has been read into the comments. Meanwhile, the government is trying again to distance itself from the Treasury estimate that Australia's population will reach 36 million by 2050. From Canberra, Samantha Hawley reports.
It's day two of the nine-day Polly Pedal, a charity event that will see the opposition leader and others ride from Melbourne to Sydney.
Look, I'm feeling slightly better than I did last night. It was a tough and hilly ride.
Tony Abbott says he's treating it as a listening tour.
How's my Iron Man?
Oh, I'm all right.
He popped in on Liberal MP Sophie Mirabella, but it's the wider party room that needs talking to. There's disquiet in coalition ranks after the opposition's immigration spokesman, Scott Morrison, earmarked a cut to overseas migration under a coalition government. The issue wasn't discussed with the party room or shadow cabinet, leading to this from Mr. Morrison.
Others have read a lot of things into this, but it's just a simple observation as to where we have got to under this government and whether that's a sustainable level of growth.
And is it coalition policy?
Now, if there is an interpretation out there that this is a wholesale policy, it's not a wholesale policy.
How can you have a population policy when you can't even govern a population of 20 in your own shadow cabinet?
The new population minister, Tony Burke, says the opposition's in chaos.
They have flipped and flopped over whether they even have a population policy.
Scott Morrison's original comments are damaging not just within the party room, but business has also rallied against the idea of a cut to net migration. The Business Council will meet the opposition in the days ahead to express its displeasure, and the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industries, Peter Anderson, wants clarification too.
We certainly would like to see the opposition develop a migration policy that is clear to the Australian community and the business community, and one which recognises the very strong contribution that skilled migration has made to the Australian economy and society.
Last year, the Prime Minister said he'd be making no apology for a big Australia after Treasury predicted the population would reach 36 million by 2050.
The problem with Mr Rudd's position is that he has glibly endorsed, without any debate, this notion of 36 million people by 2050.
Tony Burke says that's not a government ambition or policy, and in his new role he won't be coming up with a figure of his own.
To be able to give a precise projection for 2050 forwards would mean being able to accurately predict every cycle in the national and international economy. I don't see how any modelling would be capable of providing that level of precision.
Will we ever know how many people will live here?
I don't see how you can determine what the economic needs of the nation will be. You can project forward on current trends. That's what Treasury projections do. But to be able to say in 40 years' time, this is precisely what the economic needs of the nation in the new global context will be, I think it's a pretty long bow.
The opposition doesn't want to commit to a figure either.
I must say, having driven from Brisbane Airport to
Coolum on Good Friday and sat in traffic for 3 hours, I can understand people being riled at the thought that you are looking to increase the population by about 50%. I don't think we should be focused on a number. I think we should be focused on a quality of life. And that's what matters, and that's what we believe as a coalition.
Speaking on Queensland Radio, the Shadow Treasurer, Joe Hockey, provided an insight into some of his home qualities since he increased the population by one.
So your baby is still not sleeping?
No. Every 45 minutes last night, he was up. And it's part of life. I mean, many parents go through it, I'd imagine.
The Shadow Treasurer, Joe Hockey, ending Samantha Hawley's report. The continuing credit crunch has taken mortgage lending back to the future. Just like 30 years ago, if you're cashed up and have a long history with your bank, you might be lucky enough to get a loan. But those just starting out are going to have to do it the old-fashioned way and save. A new study of the mortgage industry in Australia shows that banks are changing their lending criteria. For first home buyers, that means saving 20% of your home deposit. Di Bain reports.
Baby boomers beware. According to banking analyst Martin North, borrowing from mum and dad is the only way many young Australians will be able to buy a home.
One of the trends we're now seeing is the baby boomer generation who have the equity in the properties and, you know, all of the assets are actually now using some of that to effectively kickstart the next generation. So they're actually giving or borrowing at low rates, lending at low rates to their offspring.
Baby boomers say their kids are already knocking on the door. Paul McCune runs the website Baby Boomers Life Change, where he tracks lifestyle changes of his generation. He's had to tap into his own nest egg to help his kids.
I have, and it's not uncommon. The reality is it's very difficult in the market that we've seen over the last 10 or 20 years. We tend to live with the great delusion that one of these days it might even be paid back, but we don't hold our breath.
The new lending trends have been analysed by Fujitsu Australia and JP Morgan. They've compiled a report into the changing face of Australia's mortgage industry. The report says when Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008, Australians flocked to the big banks looking for security. Now those banks own the lion's share of the home loan market. And to balance out their ledgers, they'll now ration credit and turn their focus to business lending. JP Morgan's Scott Manning says banks are demanding home buyers save more money.
Back in February 2009, about 30% of first home buyers had a loan to valuation ratio between 95 and 100%. Today, that's about 5 to 10%.
He says banks will demand a deposit of 20%, with the median house price in Australia now at more than $455,000. That's a saving requirement of $90,000. Martin North says there's a two-tiered market which has emerged. Those who are well-established financially are getting further ahead and are in some cases feeling quite wealthy.
People are feeling more affluent because, in fact, house prices are going up. And guess what? The first thing you do is actually say, gee, I'll use a little bit of that equity in the property to go buy a motor car or take a holiday. So we're seeing that. A year ago, that dropped away because of where the global financial crisis was and people were concerned about jobs. Less of an issue today.
While those who are starting out are getting further behind.
You put rates up another 2 or 3%, as you probably will have to over the economic cycle. The bulk of the economy will still survive, no problem. There will still not be a fall in house prices because we've got an undersupply, but a small proportion of house owners will fall off the perch because effectively they will be so severely stressed. And it will be focused among young families, it will be focused among first-time buyers. And a lot of those first-time buyers, the 255,000 who entered the market over the last 18 months, 40% of them are already in some difficulty with rates where they currently are. And, you know, it doesn't take much more to see that we're going to have significant issues there.
The analysts say there's not enough houses in Australia and affordability is only going to get worse. They say more political will is needed by governments to help alleviate what could turn into a major economic headache.
Di Bain. Tasmanians finally have a government, at least for the moment. The governor has commissioned the Labour leader, David Bartlett, to stay on as Premier. Mr. Bartlett will now have to test his power on the floor of the House. Our Hobart reporter Felicity Ogilvie joins me now. Felicity, it seems it was only yesterday that Will Hodgman, the opposition leader, was emerging smiling from a meeting with the governor. It looks like everybody took the wrong message away from that.
Yes, Mark, or it could have been the change that happened late yesterday when the Greens announced that they would be supporting the Labor Party. The Parliament is hung with Labor and the Liberals holding 10 seats each, the Greens holding the remaining five. The Greens have been trying to get some kind of formal arrangement with either major party. Both major parties won't enter agreement with the Greens, so the Greens have said that they will continue to support Labor and won't bring any no-confidence motions against Labor unless there's a corruption or some other major issue.
So those are the only conditions?
No, Mark. The Greens have also said that they would back down on that if the Liberals or the Labor Party wanted to enter a formal agreement. So basically the Greens were saying if the Liberals would do a formal deal with the Greens, that they would hand power to the Liberal Party.
So what's the mechanism now? What exactly happens and when?
Well, we do know that David Bartlett now is the Premier of Tasmania. We have a government tonight because that's what the Governor has declared. But now Parliament will have to be recalled. And basically, David Bartlett will want to test his power on the floor of the House. So there'll be a vote for confidence in the government, and presumably the Greens will vote that they have confidence in the government.
As I say, though, when?
Either as soon as a week's time, but they could leave it up to a month.
In the meantime, Mr. Bartlett has administrative power, at least for that week or two.
Yes, he will be considered the Premier of Tasmania, and this will be quite crucial for the COAG meeting that is coming up very soon, because David Bartlett fully supports Kevin Rudd's health plan, whereas Will Hodgman still hadn't made up his mind.
Thank you very much, Felicity. A coronial inquest into one of Australia's most controversial Aboriginal deaths in custody today heard final submissions on the fraught 2004 Palm Island case. The counsel assisting the coroner told the reopened inquest that there was not enough reliable evidence to find Senior Sergeant Chris Hurley either deliberately or accidentally responsible for Cameron Dumagee's death. He said that meant an open finding was the only option. The Dumagee family strongly disagreed. Its counsel argued that Sergeant Hurley, the officer in charge of the police station, used deliberate and severe force while the Aboriginal man lay on the floor. Annie Guest reports from Brisbane.
While they may have polarised views, the people closest to this death in custody have one thing in common. They want conclusive findings from the inquest. But if today's submission from the counsel assisting the coroner is persuasive, then they won't get it. He told the inquest a finding that Senior Sergeant Chris Hurley used deliberate force against Cameron Dumagee while he lay on the floor of the police station after an apparent struggle with the officer can't be made, because much of the circumstantial evidence is suspect, such as that from a drunk fellow prisoner, or highly qualified and does not provide the necessary certainty. Nor, he says, can it be proven that it was an accident, meaning an open finding is the only possibility. But the man at the centre of the long-running saga wants his name cleared. The counsel for Senior Sergeant Chris Hurley made this written submission to the inquest.
In all of the circumstances as it has been submitted, Your Honour would find that the injuries were accidentally caused. The only other conclusion is that Your Honour would not be able to make a finding one way or the other.
This inquest was reopened after Sergeant Hurley appealed to have the initial coronial inquest's findings set aside. That inquest found in 2006 that he was responsible for Cameron Dumagee's death. He was charged with manslaughter. But then in 2007 he was found not guilty and later set about restoring his reputation. Back to today's hearing, and also giving their submission, were lawyers for the family of Cameron Dumagee, who the inquest has been told was 36 when he was taken into police custody after swearing at officers on Palm Island. The man, also known as Mulrunyi, was dead a short time later. The family's submission reads,
Mulrunyi
died from injuries caused by the deliberate application of severe force by Senior Sergeant Christopher Hurley.
Through the two inquests, Sergeant Hurley's account of the struggle with Cameron Doomadgee has altered, and the submission on behalf of the Queensland Government's Attorney-General makes a strident reference to this.
There are circumstantial facts which point to a deliberate application of force, and the only real evidence to the contrary is the bald denial by Hurley, where he contradicts his earlier statements, and of course he offers no explanation at all as to how Mourinho suffered the injuries.
One of the major differences between the reconvened inquest and earlier examinations of the case has been the attack by the Doomadgee family's counsel about police having the same lawyer. The inquest has heard of a shoddy investigation at the crime scene, unwilling witnesses and unreliable testimony. The counsel assisting the coroner, Ralph Devlin, SC's submission reads...
From the point of view of the administration of justice, Hurley and the other police officers should have been separately represented to ensure that the integrity of independent versions of members directly involved and members who are witnesses to a police incident is preserved as far as practicable.
The Queensland Police Union responded,
"Such criticism is rejected."
Meanwhile, the union's role in the saga has been criticised by the Attorney-General. His counsel's submission says that certain features in the evidence...
paint a picture of the Queensland Police Union fairly closely controlling important witnesses, their members, and a prosecution against Hurley, their member.
The union responded,
"Unfortunately for the Attorney-General, there is a distinct lack of evidence to allow such a submission to be made."
Meanwhile, the crime watchdog has also had to defend itself. Counsel assisting has highlighted what it calls the failure of the Crime and Misconduct Commission to limit the conjoint legal representation of police witnesses by the police union. The CMC says it doesn't have that power. Meanwhile, the Deputy Chief Magistrate, Brian Hine, aims to hand down his findings into the death in custody on May the 14th in Townsville.
Annie Guest. Relations between Afghanistan and NATO have been extremely strained recently, particularly because of a series of reported comments by the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai. The president has accused foreign countries of conspiring to rig last year's elections. Several reports even suggested he'd threatened to join the Taliban if United States pressure on him didn't let up. Things weren't helped either by the former UN diplomat Peter Galbraith, who said he knew of suspicions that President Karzai was even taking drugs. The renowned French scholar of the Islamic and Arab worlds, Professor Gilles Kepel, is giving a talk at the Lowy Institute in Sydney tonight. I asked him how central Afghanistan was to the various complex issues across the Islamic world.
It is quite important because the Middle East nowadays, I think, is a system of three crises. One, which is the Levant crisis, Israel-Palestine, plus the ripple effect in Syria and Lebanon, which is probably the most loaded crisis in symbolic terms because of the fact that there are Jews everywhere, Palestinians in many countries, and this has overtones and this is spills over, if you wish. Even in Australian or French or American political debate, domestic debate.
And then other countries have proxy forces there as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, yeah. B, another axis of crisis, which I believe is much more important, even though it is less symbolically loaded, which is the Gulf crisis. Because if you don't want to come on your bicycle to the radio building in the morning, you have to have oil that comes from the Middle East, most of it. And that
when
crosses,
you say Gulf crisis, to a degree you mean Iran.
Iran versus the Arab countries of the Gulf, i.e. Persian versus Arab, also Shia versus Sunni, and oil in the middle. So this is, you know, you can't wait when you deal with the Palestinian-Israeli crisis. And we've been waiting for 50 years. I mean, no one wants to wait, but you can't wait. But you cannot wait for 24 hours if the Straits of Hormuz are blocked.
And it's really interesting that you refer to it in those terms when the rest of the world is looking at it as Israel versus Iran or the US versus Iran. And you're saying Iran versus the Arab states, Sunni versus Shia.
Well, you know, who's the sort of the most afraid of Iran becoming a nuclear power nowadays? Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, not Israel. Because Israel knows that it has the capacity to deter and to destroy Tehran even before the Pasdaran have put their finger on the trigger.
You know this from travelling in the Gulf states yourself?
Oh, yeah. I spend most of my time there.
And you've heard this from the oil sheikhs?
And, from many people down there and from Iran also. We have, together with my students, we've been working on doing field work in the Gulf for 10 years, and we have huge access to those countries. And then the third axis of crisis is what they call in the Beltway the AFPAC crisis. The Pakistanis are not pleased with that newly coined word, the Afghanistan-Pakistan crisis, which was perceived by the Obama administration when they came to power maybe as the sort of the easiest thing to deal with, i.e. Obama believed that the war in Iraq was a failure, but nevertheless that the U.S. had to win a military victory against the terrorists, i.e. against Al-Qaeda. The war against Al-Qaeda was not to be fought in Iraq, in which he was right, but in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he believed that, you were talking about a bunch of a few hundreds of people that were scattered on the Afghan-Pakistan border, and, they could be terminated with a few drones. The problem is that they were taking shelter under the Taliban, and the Taliban are not a sort of international organization which is lost in the blue or in the cyberspace. It's a grassroots movement with a very strong potential in Pakistan, on the eastern side of Pakistan, and in Afghanistan.
So finally, then, what are the chances of resolving anything there?
Well, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, it's going to be very complicated because I do not believe that that people, and we're talking about the whole NATO there, and including French forces. When you see the body of all the soldiers coming back, you wonder what they are fighting for. Are they fighting for the Karzai administration? Big question mark. This does not seem to be the right administration to spend so much money and lives on. And to what extent are we being trapped in Afghanistan nowadays, like the Russians were trapped in the 1980s and the Brits earlier on? This is not totally unthinkable. But the question, or maybe the solution to a large extent, is in Pakistan nowadays. And Pakistan is a country which is weak and which has nuclear weapons.
Gilles Capel, who's a professor in Paris and in London. And he's speaking tonight at the Lowy Institute in Sydney. Finally, to business and finance on the markets with Di Bain.
Thanks, Mark. There's been more activity in the burgeoning coal seam methane industry, with gas minnow Icon Energy saying it's signed a multi-billion dollar deal with a Chinese firm to sell LNG. Icon Energy says it has a non-binding memorandum of understanding with a unit of China's Sinogas Group to sell 40 million tonnes of LNG over 20 years. The deal is said to be worth $23 billion. The Queensland-based company doesn't produce any LNG at the moment. Merger talks between US wine company Constellation Brands and Australian Vintage are off. Constellation will continue to operate its Australian and British businesses, focusing on cutting costs and increasing efficiencies. In economic news, there's been a rise of almost 20,000 jobs in March. This puts Australia's unemployment rate at 5.3%. The Australian Bureau of Statistics says 30,100 additional full-time jobs were created last month. The All Ordinaries Index dropped 22 points to 4,960. The Australian dollar's strong. It's buying 69.4 euro cents and 92.3 US cents.
Di Bain, thanks very much. That's all in tonight's edition of PM. Back to same time tomorrow. I'm Mark Colvin. Thanks for being with me. Good night.